The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. When I was a college student, I went to college at a place nearby called Davis. And in the winter time, it would get quite cold, and we had this tule fog that would come in. And that would make it even colder in the morning. And the I had a bicycle, and so I'd bike to school. That was my means of transportation. And it never occurred to me to get gloves. And so I would go to school, and my hands would get so bitterly cold in this freezing, cold, foggy weather that literally when I got to class, it would take me a few minutes for my fingers to thaw enough to open up to hold the pen, because it was so, you know, that's how cold it was. So maybe it's foolish to have continued that way without thinking of getting gloves, but I was happy. Enough, but it was... But I remember how painful it was to go riding this bicycle and just biting pain into my hands. And I guess the kind of feeling of riding the bike, oh, poor me, or this is hard, or this is painful. And then one day I was riding my my bike to campus, and I remembered that when I was a teenager, I used to go skiing up in the mountains. And when I was skiing, I had the same sensations in my fingers. Sometimes my hands would get numb. But it was exhilarating. I had a great time. I loved it. I didn't love the hands being cold, but just the whole experience of skiing. And when I made that connection, that this was the same experience in my hands, bicycling as skiing, the self-pity or the sense of aversion or upsetness or whatever, the negative feeling I had about these cold hands, vanished. It just because I realized that there was a whole layer of interpretation, of story, of reactivity that I had on top of that, that in a different circumstance I didn't have. And so it was the contribution of my mind, part of the experience of the pain. And many people have the experience, enough people have experienced that of having pain change its nature from being something that's very difficult, very painful, to something manageable, depending on the context in which it's understood or seen. So some people, for example, can have an intense pain until they see the doctor. And when the doctor gives a diagnosis, it's like, okay, and it's kind of something relaxes and it's not quite as bad. Or the context of if you get attacked by 100 bees, swarm of bees, you might be quite upset and quite frightened or do something. But if you're responsible for some little toddlers and the bees attack, you probably don't think about yourself so much. And so there's a whole different way of holding it. Even if you got bitten, you don't really care about so much because you're trying to save and take care of the kids. Different context for understanding what's happening. So context, what we bring to it, our memories, our associations, many things contribute to how we, what we conventionally would say in English, how I experience something. And what this points to is that our experience is not just experience. It's not just pure experience that belongs to the nature of the event that we're in. That we have a hugely important part in the construction of experience from what we contribute. Our likes and dislikes, our concerns, our interpretations, our stories, our meaning-making that we add on top of it. And it's actually quite complex what we add on top of many of our circumstances. Part of the function of meditation practice, or part of the opportunity with meditation practice, is to let the mind become quiet enough, calm enough, slow enough, and sharp enough and attentive enough to notice the activities of the mind that contribute to the interpretation, the story, the complexity of what we add to the situation. So we can watch the arising of an interpretation. We can arising of a thought or a concern or a feeling And because we can see it arise in the mind, we can also possible to see how that concern, that story, that interpretation can become a filter through which we see what's going on in a way that's often very hard in daily life. In daily life, you know, we're busy, the mind's going fast, and there's not a lot of self-reflection going on, you know, careful self-awareness of what's happening in the moment. And it's all too easy to have a lot of these things operating, thoughts, feelings, interpretations, that are kind of coloring the situation, but we don't see our contribution, and so we assume that we're seeing accurately. This is how it is. And then we react accordingly. So people who do something like meditation have a slow down, get stronger mindfulness, and have the ability to see this as they arise. And this is very helpful because when we start seeing the arising of thoughts, stories, interpretations, meanings, making that we add, then we can put a question mark behind after these different things. We can question, is this really useful? Is this accurate, what I'm doing here? Some of you have heard the little fable of the ugly duckling. And the ugly duckling succumbed to a very common human tendency, which is not in the language of fairy tales, premature cognitive commitment. Premature cognitive commitment. It's meaning that the ugly duckling wasn't really a duck, right? It became this beautiful swan, but the duckling, the baby swan, thought it was a duck. And because it thought it was a duck, it thought it was an ugly duck. So had the cognition, the idea, interpretation, I'm a duck, and because of that commitment to this idea that I'm a duck, had a commitment to that, and was premature because it hadn't discovered its true nature yet, that it's a swan. So many of us have this, you know, have these ideas, these stories, and projections and all kinds of things, and then we succumb to premature cognitive commitment. Isn't that a great term? Notice next time you do that. Tell your friend, uh-oh, I'm having one of those premature cognitive commitment. I guess it's hard to see it in the moment, but I just had it. Premature cognitive commitment. So what are some of the things we have these premature cognitive commitments to? And what do we notice, you know, if we pay careful attention? And in Buddhism, they say that one of the things that people often have a premature cognitive commitment to, or interpretation that they overlay the situation, is the idea that things are either more permanent than they are, or more impermanent than they are. That things are more happy than they are, or less happy than they are. Are more happiness producing or less happiness producing? More suffering or less suffering than they are? That there's self, or things are personal, or there's not self in this, or it's impersonal. All these kinds of ideas are ideas that people can have that they lock on, get fixated on. So the idea of permanence, the premature cognitive commitment to permanence. I've been in moods that both happy moods and funky moods, where I kind of succumb to this premature cognitive commitment. Uh-oh, this is forever. I'm going to be sad forever. I'm going to be in a funk forever. Now, if I thought it out, I can think these things out well enough. I kind of know it's not going to be permanent. But the operating principle, the way my whole system is working without careful attention, it's working as if, oh no, this is it. This is the way it's going to be forever. And I had this also with being a child, with being a parent with my kids. Regularly had this idea, oh no. It's going to be this way forever. And I remember the first time I saw that in a kind of silly way was, my first son was, I don't know, just a teeny, teeny kid. He couldn't turn himself over. He was just a baby, right? The baby on the changing table. And I don't know, maybe I was dangling something above him, and so he could. And he would kind of take his arm and kind of reach out for it and kind of swat it. But he didn't have the physical ability yet to hold. His fingers didn't work that way to hold on so much to things. And I'd look at him and I'd say, well, is this guy ever going to be able to hold anything? It's never going to happen. It was embarrassing to be a parent. And then the story I like to tell of having a difficult day at home and my wife looking up at me and saying, "We're having one of those days." And as my commitment to this was forever kind of vanished. Oh, just a day. As opposed to I was kind of operating like, uh-oh, it's forever. And I've had, premature commitments to happiness as well. I had a period of my life of being kind of ecstatic, a whole summer of having a wonderful summer of being kind of ecstatic states, and coming to the conclusion that I'm never going to be depressed again. And then that fall, I was more depressed than I'd ever been in my life. So it was a little bit premature, right? The interpretation of it. And then we have the idea that things are happier than they are or less happy than they are. Sometimes we select out of an environment what we want, what our concern is, what's important for us. And it's interesting to see it shift and change. I could go for a hike, and somehow I enjoy being out there, outdoors. I enjoy the fresh air. I enjoy the movement. And even though my legs and my body is getting tired and even maybe aching a little bit from the walk, I tune in, my system is tuning in to something else which I'm enjoying. And I kind of recedes to the background this pain and suffering of the hike. I've gone with my children when they were young, and you guess what part of the experience they're tuning into. They don't enjoy the view. They don't, the view? What view, For them, they're picking out of the environment. My legs, I'm so tired. How can I make it up the hill? This is so difficult. So sometimes then we have a cookie along. And the cookies along the hike, there's changes the orientation of the kid, what it's all about, and that lasts for a little while. So it's all very fluid in our minds. And we can select out an environment, what we think is important, and what we kind of get weighed down by, or what we get buoyed up by. And different people in the same situation can choose different things to focus on, and it affects their moods quite a bit. One of the things also, this idea of commitment, interpretation that we add to the situation is the idea that it's personal, that it's about me. It's me, myself. And it's, quite impressive how much human beings are looking at the environment, looking at situations through the filter of me, myself, and mine. What's in it for me? Where do I fit in this? Sometimes it's seen through the filter of what I want, my desires. Sometimes my fears, what I'm afraid of. Sometimes my aversions, what I don't like, what I'd want to avoid. Or what do people think about me? How are people going to see me? How do I want to present myself so people see me in a particular way? There's a whole way in which we see it through the filter of self, self-building, self-creating. But we don't have to. It's possible to see it in other ways. And I apologize if I'm using all these parenting examples. But I noticed also when my wife and I were young parents, very young parents, there wasn't time to shower, there wasn't time to change clothes, tired, and I couldn't care less anymore what people thought about me. I'd go out, I'd go shopping, and whereas before kids, maybe I was more concerned by my looks and how I looked. I looked, well-kept or something. And who could care less? That was like the last thing in my mind. So it was kind of letting go of a certain kind of self-concern because the whole situation was so, I guess, demanding or something. So the shifting nature of, what we look at, and some of you, I'm sure, have seen the shifting nature of the focus on self because probably the kind of self-concerns you had when you were teenagers and what kind of things that you orient to, what you were interested in, are very different than when you're 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. That it's all the shifts and all that. And how you looked and how attractive you were are probably more important for you when you were young, and probably for some of you it gets less and less important as you get older. And so some people find that their concern about looking attractive for the sake of other people becomes less important after a while than feeling comfortable in their clothes. And so they shift, you know, the clothes they make. So the orientation, which it shifts and changes what we focus on. So these things are fluid. And so the point being that all these things, all these interpretations, stories, commitments, ideas we have that we overlay, we add to the experience of what's going on in the moment, all of them are activities of the mind and are not fixed and inherent to the nature of reality. And so part of what we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is to become calm enough in the mind and attentive enough in the mind that we can begin seeing how this works and take responsibility for how it works. So we're not, if we're not attentive enough and this stuff is working subconsciously or in the background, that we're going to be pushed around and make choices that we don't understand why we're doing things and maybe later regret. But the idea is to start taking responsibility for the interpretations we have, responsibility for the orientation, the perspective we use to look at any given situation. So, and we always come with a perspective. Almost always we have a perspective about the situation we're in. And so do we understand the perspective-making function of the mind, how it works? Do we understand what the perspective is that we have now? So we can ask, what perspective do I bring? I think it's a great question. What perspective do you have right now? Because there's always going to be one, but so often it's not examined. It's unexamined. It's operating there in the background, having a big impact on the situation. But if you don't understand the perspective, you have less choice. You have less freedom in the situation. Because perhaps the perspective you have is not the most useful one to have. If you really clearly saw the perspective you're operating under, you might realize you don't believe it. Or you might realize that it's not so useful, there's more useful ones. So there is a movement sometimes, you know, positive thinking movement, that one version of it is you realize you have a negative train of thought about something, negative interpretations about things, and so you substitute it with a positive interpretation, a positive story. It's a little bit dangerous because it's possible then to just cover over the festering views and feelings that we have and kind of pretty things over. Kind of Pollyannish at times. But in Buddhism also there's a emphasis not just to see what's there and be free of it, but rather to also choose more useful perspectives. And I like the word perspective as opposed to interpretation, because perspective means a vantage point through which you're looking at things. So what vantage point do you look at a situation? Do you look at it through the vantage point of what's in it for me? Do I look at it through the vantage point of what I can contribute to the people I'm with? Do I look through the vantage point of how I can be more comfortable? Do I look at it through the vantage point of how I can help other people be more comfortable? Do I look at it through the vantage point of how I can get away with the least possible amount of work? Do I look at it through the vantage point of how can I do this work or this activity so that it benefits me or benefits other people? There's many, many different vantage points. So the vantage point that you choose has a big impact on how everything unfolds. It has a big impact on what you see and what you can discover in any given situation. So I'd like to offer you a vantage point, a perspective that's useful to bring. And I'd like to offer it in the context of situations where you think you have a problem. You think that something is going wrong, that things shouldn't be happening this way. So you have a big problem, things shouldn't be happening this way. So when you feel that way, when you have that interpretation, that's an interpretation, that's a story. It might be a very compelling story, so compelling that, you know, anybody who tells you you don't have a problem when you have a problem seems like, you know, leave me alone. This is not being realistic. But there are plenty of situations, I think, that people find themselves where they think that this is a big problem, big challenge, this is a big mistake, this shouldn't be happening while it's happening. And later they look back and they realize this is the best thing that ever happened to me. It changed me, it bettered me, it made me a better person. I'd be a poor, my life would be so much poorer if I didn't go through this hugely transformative experience that I went through. And so the perspective we see it later is very different when we go through it in the middle. So I'd like to offer you a different perspective than the perspective that you have a problem or something's wrong or something's terrible or this shouldn't be happening. And that is a perspective or the vantage point, to approach it with a vantage point. How can I approach a situation so my approach is helpful? How can I approach a situation so I or the situation can benefit from my involvement? So it's not exactly saying this is what's happening and interpreting or putting a value on it. It's kind of taking the situation kind of as it is and then taking responsibility, taking some freedom of choice for a purpose that betters you or betters the situation. So what do you do with it? What do you do with the situation? Rather than succumbing and being weighed down by the situation, we take charge in a certain way. Maybe you can't change the situation so much, even if it's a fixed situation. But maybe you can't change the fact that you're going to take the train up to San Francisco. And for some reason, Caltrain's decided that day to not have the 10 o'clock train. The next train's going to be in 2 hours. But it's supposed to be one at 10, but they just, decided, didn't need one today. So then you have to wait 2 hours there. So that's a bummer. That's a problem. That's a drag. And you can go mope around and be angry with Caltrans. Or you can say, yes, all that's true in a certain way, that it's unfortunate, it's difficult, messes up your plans. But to take control of the situation or find your freedom in the situation, you're probably better off looking at the situation through the vantage point. Given that the fact that the train is late, how do I make the most of this now? What do I do now so it betters me? So you might decide to sit quietly on the bench and meditate, and get calm and settle and use this for meditation. You have trouble. A lot of people tell me that I have a lot of trouble finding time to meditate in my life. Here's your chance. Here's your chance. maybe there's other things you could do that would, support you. Or you might decide to make the most of a situation. This is the opportunity to really look more deeply than you ever have. You have 2 hours to look at it deeply. Your tendency towards impatience, to anger, to self-righteousness, and to taking things personally. It's, Caltrans has a thing for you. And so you sit there and you use this as a way of really doing some deep inner searching and understanding how all this works for you in a way you've never had before. For example, so there's many answers to the question, how can I make the most of the situation? But for someone who does a practice, like Buddhist practice, then there's always the opportunity to say, how can I use this as my practice? How can I develop myself, develop mindfulness, develop stability of mind, develop compassion, develop greater self-understanding? How can I practice in this situation? And I've known people who have gone into surgery. I remember one person who told me this very clearly. She asked me before surgery what she could do, and I said, why don't you do some loving-kindness meditation in preparation for the surgery? So she did, and she came out and said, I've done a lot of surgeries before, but always before, I felt like I was just a passive victim. I just lay there on the bed until they knocked me out, and I had nothing I could do, and then I wake up, and surgery's over. But with it, metta, doing metta meditation, loving kindness beforehand, I felt I had some efficacy. I felt I had a role or something I can do. And there's a certain kind of sense of empowerment that it was really nice for her to have. Even she could practice in the situation. She wasn't just a kind of just hopeless for her personally to be involved. So we can always practice in the situation. So we sit to get quiet, slow down a little bit, and to strengthen our ability to pay attention. One of the things we can notice is that we have this overlay or filter through which we see things of a perspective, an interpretation, a story, an idea, a concern that we have, that we look through a situation. It's possible to see that involvement with a concern, interpretation, a story. It's possible to put a question mark after it, saying, is this really true? Is this really useful to have this perspective? What's my relationship to this perspective I'm carrying? Is there premature cognitive commitment? Or would it be useful to not to have this commitment, I know what's happening, but rather right now to have a little bit more not knowing mind, a little bit more, let's be open to explore this and get to know it. Maybe I don't know it really completely well. And then it's possible to relax and let go of some of the perspectives we have that are not useful. And it's possible in some situations to ask ourselves a question, are there a different perspective, vantage point, that would make that it's more useful for the situation I'm in? And the suggestion I have is that the more useful perspective is not one that just say this is what's going on, but the useful perspective is one that says, what can I do with this situation make the most of it, so it's better for everyone involved. It's better for me, so I grow from it. This is what practice is involved. And sometimes what's the best thing to do in a situation, especially when you meditate, but some other time, is to let go more deeply. Just let go. Because as we let go deeply, especially this meditation is a prime place for this, we begin letting go of needing to have the mind be so active and busy. Because it's not just simply a matter of changing our perspective, it's learning how to have less and less perspective. Learning how to see, be present in a very simple, simple way, so that we can be at rest and at ease in this life. Because as long as we're involved with making perspective, interpretations, and stories, we're not that at ease. They might, even if it's good perspectives and useful ones, it doesn't allow us the deepest resting or being at ease for ourselves. And so part of this value of seeing the perspective-making aspect of the mind is to help us also to learn to let go of even good perspectives so that we can have the experience of the heart being at rest in itself, the mind at rest in itself. And then the last thing I'll say is when the mind is at rest in itself, when the heart is at rest in itself, one of the very important functions of that is that it's a lot easier then to see when the activity of the mind starts up and we start seeing how we grab on, what we interpret, what we're doing in the mind. It's very hard to see, really see the mind clearly when it's swirling and thinking and doing. It's a lot easier to see it when the mind becomes really, really still. So the stiller we mind becomes, the more responsibility we can take for the mind, which is another way of saying the more choice we have for what the mind does, and the more choice that we have, the more freedom we have as well. So, that's what I have to say today. So, now it's your turn. What would you like to say?
I'm thinking about the part of letting go more. And when you say it, I feel a twinge of fear. And then I comforted myself saying, well, I need to have faith in things working out. Is that the direction you mean, or am I just laying another perspective on it?
It certainly is a perspective that I need to have faith. It's possible that's, you know, certainly it could be a useful perspective, useful idea. But then the question is, how do you do that? What's a useful way of doing that? And so is it you force yourself to have faith? You know, it's kind of like just kind of convince yourself and have a lot of words and say, yes, I can trust this, I can trust this, I can trust this. or is a useful way to approach having more faith or trust to turn the attention and get to know your fear better? And this is one of the approaches of mindfulness practice. One of the possibilities of mindfulness is whatever the challenge is, to turn towards it rather than cover it over. And so something of fear, which is an inner emotional reaction and response, that it might be more useful to go in and look really deeply at the roots of the fear and transform it, and in that process discover faith, as opposed to try to overlay faith on top of it or balance, or, you know, balance it out with faith. Does that make sense?
I'm trying to picture how I would find faith by examining my fear more. When I find the fear in me, I try to do that, to look inward, to see what it is, and it seems to go into hiding.
Maybe. It's possible it's going into hiding. It's also possible that it's not so strong, the fear. Depends how... so if you... you know, if it keeps repeating, if it's strong enough, the fear, and it keeps disappearing, then perhaps you need to find a different way to look at it or be present for it. Sometimes you want, as an art, to maybe not looking so carefully, maybe trying to look from a distance. Or maybe putting yourself in a situation where the fear can stay active, so you can stay present and watch it. There's a term, psychological term, of hovering with an emotion, to let it kind of stay there. So many years ago, over 20 years ago, I spent a little bit of time with a therapist, and she pointed out that because of my years of Buddhist practice, I was a little bit too good at letting go. And it was too easy. So she wanted me to look at my anger. So she said, Gil, you have to let the anger hover. Let it stay, so that it doesn't, you know, you can really understand it more deeply and carefully. So I found that useful, this idea of hovering or staying, keeping it there for a while to look at it. The other thing that I found very helpful in something like fear is to feel it in the body, because sometimes it's a little more difficult for it to hide if you're staying connected with the sensations of the body, because sensations don't usually disappear that quickly.
When you say your anger and just look at it and hovering, do you mean that and turn towards what's bothering you, or do you mean analyzing it, or do you mean feeling it,
or what?
Feeling, just feeling it.
Yeah.
How do you confronted, not confronted, but just let it be in the hover.
Yeah. What do you mean by analyzing?
Like understanding where it comes from. Uh-huh.
Both are very useful. Sometimes it's very useful to understand where it comes from, and in some forms of therapy, that's one of the primary approaches they have, where they understand like the childhood roots of it, and, you know, what's going on. And some people find that liberating. In the mindfulness practice itself that we do here, we tend to, for the purposes of the meditation itself, we strongly de-emphasize the analytical part, especially the historical reasons, in favor of seeing the situation how it is in the present moment, right now, here and now. And then in doing that with emotions, it's one of the best things to do is to feel it in your body. But to see, then learn to feel it without reacting to it, just simple there in the body. And then as we do this and the mind quiets down and can see more clearly, then at some point or other, it's possible to see, not analytically, but directly, the steps or the causes, the conditions for which the feeling is there here and now. So, for example, a person might be angry, and instead of analyzing, just really be present for the anger and feel it in the body, learn how to let go of the aversion to the anger, or the fear of the anger, just feel it. Just be very simple with it and feel it in the body, feel it. As you're feeling the anger, some people might see that the anger begins shifting, and then it shifts and morphs, changes into maybe what's deeper. And what's deeper is maybe underneath the anger was fear. It's one of the conditions for the rising of anger sometimes. And then you see that the anger arose because of the fear that I had. As opposed to anger arose because of what happened long ago, you know, and I was... But you see, there's a connection here and now. I see it works here and now like this way. It's not exactly analytical. It's revelatory. It gets revealed. So, does that make sense?
I know very well my fears and doubts when they come up. And I kind of know the cause and condition. I've done a lot of work on that. But I wanted to see if you could tie this into the talk you did last week where you're getting a sense of self about no self or about what happens when you let go and what there is then on the other side. You know, and you were saying something about the Buddha having this strong sense of confidence or empathy or connection. So if I would let go of this primary delusion and some of my fears, just let go and breathe into it and find something more helpful, then what does the other side kind of look like? When last week you were saying developing a sense of self about no self,
so you're saying that if you're able to do this process of letting go of your attachment to self?
Yeah, an attachment to my fear or whatever.
Yeah. So I think that, what's on the other side? If attachment and fear is dropped away, then a person is more peaceful. So the other side is peace. If that sense of peace or well-being is meaningful, then knowing that you have the ability to do a practice that helps you let go of fear, for example, provides a person with confidence. Mm-hmm. I can do this. If you have never done it, if you've never had fear or attachment to something and let go of it, then you have no confidence that you can let go of it, and then you're kind of just a victim of your attachment. So the confidence arises in a person from practicing successfully, having results that work. Make sense?
Are you trying to tell us that it would be preferable to avoid it, kind of pre-classifying things as neither good nor bad, redeemable or irredeemable in terms of situations, but rather to see if one's own, if one thinks that one is the cause of this situation and thereby is kind of overwhelmed with regret. Since one can't go back and undo the past and make it better, then you're saying that we should not, or would be preferable to find a way out of that prejudgment that I'm at fault, I'm a bad person, I had a choice, did the wrong thing, made the mistake, and now I'm stuck.
Yeah.
And it's that does your talk relate to that, how to get out of that bind?
Yeah, I think anytime you're in a bind or you feel stuck in anything, it's not so useful. And so it's good to kind of free ourselves from the being in the bind or being stuck. And some people are stuck in the past. And part of the stuck in the past sometimes is stuck in a self-understanding, self-concept, which is arises out of the past that we're stuck in. So the question of good and bad, generally, I think most Buddhists I know prefer not to look at things through the vantage point of good and bad, but look at the vantage point of what's useful and not useful, what's helpful and not helpful. So that means you kind of look and see the consequences. So if you're looking at, you know, the vantage point of good and bad, or I suck because of what I did in the past, it's hopeless or not, then is it useful to, what ways is it useful to see good and bad? What ways is it useful to see I suck as a person? And what ways is it unuseful? And is there a more useful way of looking at it? And everything has a time and season. So maybe there's a time and season to appreciate that you suck. You know, the situation is bad. But probably those are pretty rare occasions. And so it's probably more useful to kind of look at it from a different vantage point. And the vantage point that Buddhism offers is a very hopeful vantage point. The vantage point of Buddhism is we're never ultimately stuck. And it's possible to make a difference. One of the primary reasons for teaching the teachings on karma in Buddhism is to, in Buddhists are supposed to have faith in karma, but what the primary reason of this faith or trust in karma is the same thing as having faith and confidence that we can make a difference. That what we are, what our actions, our activities are consequential, and we can choose and act in ways that are for our betterment, to improve us. We're never stuck. And one of the ways to be unstuck is to look at the situation and see, how can I make the most of this? How can I go forward from here? And so in terms of the past, the kind of the approach in Buddhist spirituality to the past and what we've done in the past and the regrets about the past, situations past, is to look at it just enough to learn from the situation and be inspired to do better in the future. But don't look at it so much that it weighs you down. Don't ignore it entirely, then we might repeat the same mistakes. Okay, so we should stop. So thank you very much.